Blog Talk Radio.
From the deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, the SRI Label Group, Wildlife Educational Services, and Blog Talk Radio present Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover with us the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we discover his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, broadcasting on this magical network known as Blog Talk Radio, as it looks like a little bit of winter has come into Indiana. I'm not a bit darn happy about it, but we've got a great show. Lyle Blackburn is going to be joining us, musician, cryptozoologist, a really pretty cool guy. We've got lots of music to play and talk to Lyle about the many books that he's written about the weird world of monsters in the swamps and so forth. And of course, our monster in the swamps from Indianapolis, Indiana, and the Wild World News headquarters, the Honorable Distinguished, always prompt, always he's up to date with the world events. Dr. Henry Day, good afternoon, Doc.
Good afternoon, Mr. Batson. We're excited about today's guest.
We are. So it should be a best show today. Yeah, it should be outstanding. So what have you been up to?
Oh, just doing a little work around the house. Had to do some painting, some sanding. When you own a house, you have to do stuff like that.
Yeah, I always said when you first buy the house, you plan on being broke for the first couple of years because of, you know, of all the maintenance and stuff you want to do for yourself. So what about the Wild World News headquarters? Is still the Knotty Pine paneling? Are you happy with that we installed in that particular studio?
It is quite lovely and great for sound, too.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. So are you ready with Dr. Day with the Wild World News?
I am. I want to get Lyle on. We need to talk to Lyle.
I know. All right. Got it.
Let's do it.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good afternoon. It's like 43 degrees here in Indianapolis. I wish we were in Texas with Lyle. It's probably a little warmer there.
Not too much.
Yeah, doesn't sound happy about that either.
No, it's Texas. It should be hot.
That's right. All right, Mr. Batson, this first story is going to remind you of a couple of odd friends that you had, a couple of animal friends. I'm going to start out in Charlotte, North Carolina today. An animal shelter says the close bond between a donkey and an emu that can barely stand to be separated may complicate an adoption. Yeah, somebody's trying to adopt one of the animals. Now, the animals sleep together and they cuddle together.
Well,
a donkey and emu.
That's what, you know, they both require about the same thing, you know, fenced-in pasture. They eat similar foods. So I would think for someone that has a farm and wants something a little unique and different, that would be right up their alley.
Adopt both of them. Don't adopt just one. Now, I remember years ago, you had a skunk and a scarlet macaw that loved each other.
Yeah,
like
the bird,
donkey and emu.
The bird loved the skunk. And if you got too close to the skunk, the bird would chase you and try to inflict serious injuries. So it got pretty annoying after a while. Loved it.
Yeah, well, I remember going into the monkey house and seeing the skunk and the parrot come out from underneath an old antique stove. They slept under the stove at night.
You know, it was a little weird. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it was a little weird, but it was interesting.
Yeah.
We got some good news out of Grand Junction, Colorado. All 27 wild horses put up for adoption from the Northwest Colorado herd were sold at auction.
Wow. amazing.
Yeah, they were worried. They were worried the horses were running out of food, so they rounded them all up, and they all have homes now.
Well, good. I hope they're the right homes. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that is good news. All right, now to Wilmington, Delaware. For the first time since 1973, a loggerhead sea turtle has successfully hatched eggs on one of Delaware's beaches there. Now, we're not going to tell you where the beach is because we don't want people out there looking for baby turtles.
That's right. That's a good idea. Totally.
Yeah, that is good. Some good news. All right. Now, Fort Worth, Texas. You might have heard about this. A Goodwill worker collecting clothes and other items at a sorting center found an albino python inside one of the bins.
Cool.
Yeah, that's nothing. The worker was not excited, but say we're excited about that, but the worker was not excited at all.
Let me think about this. Was the worker angry?
Let's see. No, not angry.
Was he scared blankless?
You could say that, yes.
I'm hoping there'll be a video release. That would be phenomenal.
Yeah, well, at least it was found alive, and they're taking care of it. All right, I got two gator stories for you in unusual places. Kansas City, Missouri. A landlord stumbled upon an unwanted house guest as he was evicting a tenant. Yes, there was a 6-foot alligator in the hot tub.
That's funny.
Yeah, probably having a pretty good time.
Well, you remember my alligator rescue story from years ago. A small suburb of Indianapolis, I got a call that someone was living in a house, and they moved that person from the house to the nursing home. And when the landlord started going through the house, inspecting it, checking it room by room, he walked into one room, and there was a big kiddie pool sitting in the middle of the room with an 8-foot alligator sitting right in the middle of the kiddie pool. So apparently the old guy had been raising a gator for a while, and we had to capture the alligator. And what was really funny is the guy that owned the house, he said, "Well, I understand that alligator is just a big pet. It's just a big pet." I said, "Sir, let me explain something to you. It might be a big pet to the guy that fed it every day, but me, no, I am not. It's friend, you know. Alligators are very intelligent. Now, do you have alligators down where you're at, Lyle?"
Yeah, we got a few, and increasingly more in the eastern parts of Texas. You know, of course, it gets close to Louisiana. So yeah, we definitely got some down here.
Yeah. Well, they're amazing. You know, I tell people years ago that 45 years ago, alligators were almost extinct in the U.S. because of the hide industry. But when they made it illegal to kill them, they're pretty good parents. Now they estimate that in Florida alone, there's close to 1 million alligators. It did make a comeback. It was successful. So, okay, Dr.
Obviously. All right, here's your other alligator story. Waukegan, Illinois, a 4-foot alligator was rescued recently from Lake Michigan after someone reported swimming near the city there. And as we know, with the waters getting a little colder, he wouldn't have survived the winter. So we're glad that the alligator was rescued in Illinois.
And I'm kind of thinking about this, Dr. Day. I don't know if we have that line open to London or not, but I was kind of wondering what Dave Davies would think about an alligator swimming around in Lake Michigan, because I know he apparently, the Kinks played Illinois. So...
Dave, have you got to that? Dave, you with us? Dave, you know I'm here. Well, did you hear that last story, Dave?
You know, I was paying attention. This is an alligator, right? Yeah, we're talking about alligators. Well, I've never been to Lake Michigan, but I hear it's really beautiful. I can tell you about hedgehogs, but I don't know nothing about alligators. This thing tastes like chicken.
Give us a hedgehog fact, Dave.
Oh, they're quite stinky and pointy.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm taking notes, so thank you very much. That was phenomenal. Tell him thanks, Dr. Day.
Thank you, Dave. Check in anytime you want.
Oh, do what you do.
Well, here's another story. Thank you, Dave. Here's another story you're going to be excited about, since you're a rattlesnake fan. A possible global warming story. We're heading to Cadiz, Ohio. A nearly 5-foot-long rattlesnake has been found in eastern Ohio, which is well north of its normal habitat. So what are we talking about here? You might be able to walk out your back door and find rattlesnakes before too long.
Well, apparently it's not. If they found one there, it's in their habitat. You know, the scientists don't know everything about this stuff. I had a guy
one time.
You know, I had a guy, I was doing a program in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I had a timber rattlesnake that I was using for my lecture, and it was a state record for Indiana. It was well over 6.5 feet long. And the guy come up and says, "That ain't no timber rattlesnake, that's a diamondback." I said, "No, sir, it's a timber rattlesnake." "Well, no, it ain't. They don't get that big." I said, "Now, how do you reply to that when the snake's right there and you're looking at it? They don't get that big." Well, apparently they do. So when I went and got a couple of U.S. Fish and Wildlife officers to identify the snake as a timber rattlesnake, then he wanted to fight me. Only Pennsylvania. My gosh. Okay, Doc. Yeah.
Well, since you mentioned Pennsylvania, that's where we'll head, Pittsburgh. Now, a fox had to be rescued from the roof of Pittsburgh's most exclusive social club. Yes, it's unclear how the gray fox managed to get on top of the club, but the animal welfare workers brought it safely down to the ground and released it. What's a wolf doing on a roof? I don't know.
God bless them. My goodness. Good for them.
All right, now we're heading off to Monterey, California. Now, we have a good friend that lives out there. He's been on the show a few times, Al Jardine of the Peace Board.
Yes.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Well, we know that he's a big whale fan. Well, he's got some good news going on there now. Scientists exploring the seafloor off the coast of Central California found more than 1,000 octopuses tucked between the rocks, with their tentacles inverted and covering clusters of white eggs. Yes, it's mating season for the octopuses in Monterey.
That's cool. I always loved octopuses. I think they're brutal. They're quite intriguing, quite intelligent. People have no idea how smart they are.
That is true, yes. And they also taste good.
Well, you know, I could never eat one because I one time had to do a show in Cleveland, Ohio, and they asked me if I would set up a facility that would house over 100 lobsters, which is quite an undertaking for just a 5-day show. So we brought in all the sea water and then 100 lobsters in from Maine. And I was really proud of ourselves because here we set this tank up so quickly. And one of the lobsters, we only had one pass away. And, you know, I always thought that lobsters, you know, were scavengers. That if one did die, the other would just eat it. And that wasn't the case at all. What they would do is every lobster in that tank, and we're talking over 100, would walk up to that one that had passed and with its two front claws, would touch the lobster that had passed and then walk away from it. It was the wildest thing I'd ever seen. And for years after that, I could not eat lobster. Wouldn't happen. No.
Understand.
So, yeah, well, that's the end of my story.
All right. Okay, we're heading off to San Clemente, California. Now, lifeguards there had to help rescue a giant sea turtle after it accidentally became hooked by an angler. They got the turtle to shore, removed the hook, released it. Now, the lifeguards received, for helping the turtle, a year's supply of turtle wax.
How appropriate.
I was waiting.
You know, Dr. Day, what turtle wax is good for, besides waxing your car? Repairing CDs. If you have a CD, which not many of them around now, I guess, that has a skip in it, a scratch on it, you take turtle wax and then wipe it on the surface of that where the scratch is. It will go away and it will play perfectly.
Well, that's a pretty interesting fact of the day. I did not know that.
Yeah, that's my fact of the day. Yeah, it works. I tried it once.
Well, all right. Well, just when you thought it was safe to go back into the water, Providence, Massachusetts, researchers studying the growing population of great white sharks off of Cape Cod have completed a five-year effort to tag and track the powerful predators. So now what they're saying is there are a lot more great whites in the shark, great white sharks in the water there off of Providencetown. So.
You know, the ocean's a big darn place. I get aggravated when people think they know what lives and how many of what lives in the ocean. That's just aggravating.
Yeah, it does me too.
It's just like when we're going to be talking with Lyle Blackburn here in a little bit. And, you know, we have extensive wilderness areas and where things could live and not be found. And that's why this the Bigfoot Sasquatch legend is so frustrating when people say, well, we know everything that lives. No, we don't. We do not. In fact, just recently they discovered a new type of primate. I believe it was in the Cameroons in Africa. And, you know, and that area had been inundated with scientists over the years, and no one had found it before. So this one group went in there. So, you know, and the ocean, my gosh, the ocean is, you know, there's stuff
right.
That comes up every day that you don't know what the heck it is. So, sorry.
Exactly. All right, let's do the local news. Indianapolis, Indiana. Jurassic Quest, the traveling animatronic dinosaur experience, that calls itself the largest and most realistic dinosaur event in North America, is coming to the Indiana State Fair next week.
Cool.
If you want to go see some realistic dinosaurs, head out to the Indiana State Fair on the 16th and 18th.
Take your little grandchildren to it and scare the hell out of them.
That's right. All right, it's time for your favorite part of the show. Who's gotten older?
Oh, thanks.
Yep.
I hate this.
Now, Lyle, he really sucks at this. So you're probably going to win today.
Okay.
We'll tell him his prize. Yeah, we'll tell him his prize later.
Yeah, okay. We're going to start out today with singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. How old do you think Joni turned this past week?
Oh, 81.
Okay, I'm going to undercut. I'll say 75.
Whoa, this rarely happens. Mr. Batson, she turned 75 on Wednesday this past week.
Oh, that's an act of God. I don't know how the heck that ever.
You got one right. That is amazing.
Jesus Christ.
All right, singer. I don't know what to say about that. All right, let's do singer Bonnie Raitt. How old do you think Bonnie turned this past week?
73. I think he's pretty close, but I'll say 68.
Whoa. Well, Bonnie Raitt turned 69 on Thursday.
Say right. I never do this.
I don't know what to think. All right, now this one is going to throw you off. Singer Art Garfunkel.
Oh.
76.
I'll say 72.
Well, Lyle beat you on this one. Art turned 77 on Monday this past week.
Oh, well.
Well, see, there you go. That's it. All right. All right, singer Bryan Adams.
Ooh, that's a hard one.
And Let's see, in summer of 69, he was what, 17 or something?
There's some logic. There you go.
Do some math. He's like, he's 67. I don't know.
I think he's probably close. I'll say 71. I know I'm way off.
Yeah, well, Brian's going to be pissed at both of you. He just turned 59 on Monday.
Oops.
Yeah.
All right.
I haven't seen him in years, so I had no reference.
All right, we're going to, I think we're done with that. We're going to head off to Hartford, Connecticut. Now, rock musician Tina Weymouth. Now, Mr. Batson, who is she?
She is the wife of Chris France, and they both were members of the band Talking Heads.
Yep, and the Tom Tom Club.
And
Chris France. Chris France has been on the show, I think, three times at least. We love having him on the show. Well, listen to this. Rock musician Tina Weymouth, a founding member of the bands, the Talking Heads and the Tom Tom Club, is among three women who were inducted to this year into Connecticut's Women's Hall of Fame.
She deserves it.
Yeah, absolutely does.
And you remember what I told Chris when he was on the show the last time, that if the Talking Heads, the original band, would get back together, that would be almost, because they're still so popular and their music still sounds so current, that probably would end up being a stadium tour. Because, you know, still a band, but anyway.
And as we know, they put on one heck of a show.
Yes, they do. Watch the video Stop Making Sense, and that'll show you right there.
Yeah, that'll change your whole life. All right, well, we need to get Lyle on. We're spending too much time on this. Let's do our fact of the day and be on with it. All right, the fact of the day is a newborn Chinese water deer is so small it can almost be held in the palm of the hand.
Really?
One time. That is right. Now, that's the Wild World News for November 11th.
Once again, a great job done by Dr. Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, all HD. As we mentioned earlier, that beautiful knotty pine paneling makes wonderful acoustics. So we get his signal in with his wonderful news stories, the game that I don't like very much, Who's Gotten Older, and of course his fact of the day. It's always fun here on Blog Talk Radio.
ghost of the past.
Guys,
we had a blast in the Hocking Hills, didn't we? The Hocking Hills Bigfoot Conference there in Ohio.
Absolutely. I love the setting of that one there in the hills, out in the countryside. Yeah, just a super, super cool event.
And Dr. Day, you should have seen Lyle's booth. It was extraordinary. He's written all these great books on the Falk Monster and monsters and, well, I'm looking at Lizardman, unbelievable, and all these great books. And I made a joke because all the T-shirts he sells are black, which is, you know, is obviously appropriate. I said, you don't have anything in the summer pastel. He said, no, we're all out of those.
That's because usually the shirts start with something that I want. You know, I'm like, I need a shirt like this, Legend of Boggy Creek, and there are none. So then I can't just make one, so then I ended up making a lot of them and then selling them to all my friends. So that's why they're usually black, because I have a kind of appreciation for that color.
Yeah, I know. I was just being a smart aleck about pretty much that.
Exactly.
And you explained to me at the conference that really music was your first job, if you want to put it that way, which it is really a job. And your monster stuff that you do at the various conferences is secondary. But boy, oh boy, you do both outstanding. This Ghoul Town, I've been on YouTube and watched several of the videos. This is pretty extraordinary. You got quite a band there.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's something that we've been doing for quite a while. And, you know, I had been in bands prior to that, really going back all the way to since I was in high school. I was already on a vinyl record with a band that I had back then. So I had a long history of music and stuff, and sort of everything that was involved with cryptozoology and all that was just something I did and read up on and studied in spare time, and until I decided to write a book about the Boggy Creek case. And then that sort of spun things around, and suddenly there was a good response on that. So then I'm like, well, this all sounds good, and I love writing these books. So then I just sort of became a juggler of sorts, where I juggle the music and the books and the Bigfoot stuff.
You know, when you write books, now many, many years ago, I was talking to a couple of boys from Arkansas that put out several fishing books, and they said that what they would do, because they're traveling all the time, going in between maybe sportsman shows and doing seminars and traveling to various fishing tournaments, so they keep these little recorders in the front seat of their truck. They get an idea as they're driving down the road, you just turn on the recorder, and they would talk basically their thoughts in the recorder. Then when they get home, they give it to a stenographer and they put it into text. How do you do your books?
Well, I do that in to some extent, just not so much to just write the actual text, but if I visit, I don't know, for example, I'm at Honey Island Swamp or something, and I visit that, and I'm looking at the environment. When I leave, I'll just sort of, you know, record some of my observations and notes that I will later listen to and incorporate into a section if I'm writing it about that particular location or the Honey Island Swamp Monster or what have you. But mostly my preferred style or writing is just to type and let the words flow out that way. And so, you know, the observations or anything I record is just simply for reference.
Sure. This Bogey Creek, now, my wife, she still says that the original film, Legend of Bogey Creek, as a drive-in, probably one of the greatest drive-in films ever. She can still remember the screams that were interpreted tape. Never mind. On the film. And so how deep did you get into going in? Did you have a chance to spend some time into that swamp, that area?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that, you know, that I've been there more than any other place, I guess, as far as doing outdoor research. And it's about 3.5 hours from where I live, so it's, you know, obviously convenient and fortunate, since I had also seen the movie when I was young, and, you know, it totally captivated my imagination. And the thought of that there could be a Sasquatch-like creature living in those bottomlands out there was captivating. So, you know, I've spent obviously many hours up there interviewing people, getting to know some of the local historians, and that all translated into the book, as well as spending time literally in the places where people had significant sightings, and just up and down the Mercer Bayou, the Sulphur River, and of course Boggy Creek itself. So yeah, I've spent many a night up there and enjoyed every minute of it.
What were your first thoughts when you went there for the first time?
My first impression was, it certainly, you know, you hear these stories and you hear the accounts, and everybody kind of tells you, oh, you know, that was this, that was that. But when you go to the place yourself, and especially when you can go out in the, you know, the remote bottomlands, it gives you a perspective that, you know, you can't get, you know, just Googling it or something. And my impression was that absolutely, you know, a small population of some unknown creature could survive down there and be relatively unseen, just simply because there's so much area and it's so rugged and swampy. There's not much development out there. It's thick. It's got all the necessary ingredients for survival, such as, you know, the food, the water resources, and the cover. So I felt like, you know, there's definitely could be something to this, you know, case and all the sightings.
When you first started talking to people that had sightings, what were your thoughts then? I mean, how did these people, were they like terrified? Were they concerned? What was the reaction you got from them?
Well, when I first started interviewing people, you know, I found that a lot of them were somewhat reluctant. You know, they were, you could tell they were a little gun shy on ridicule and things like that. And some of the witnesses, especially some of the ones that had the original or older sightings, you know, they weren't just ready to broadcast their story to just anybody. So it took me a little bit to kind of convince the folks around there that I was doing a serious book and I wasn't there to make fun of it. I'm simply reporting the facts and the observations that people had in the area of whatever wildlife may be out there. And after a while, I kept showing back up, and they got the, you know, felt that I was, you know, capable and was going to write a good book. So once they started opening up, that's when I really got the people that, definitely had no motive or anything for telling these stories. They were just simply reporting what they had seen with their own eyes and their observation. So I felt at that point that, man, there is something going on down here. You know, I can't say 100% as to what they saw, but there's a number of those individuals that not only did I meet at the time and was impressed by their story, but I've since gotten to know them and even their families, because I've been there so many times that I can absolutely vouch for the, you know, the credibility of these stories. So I was very impressed. I mean, there was a few that I thought, I think they're just hopeful they saw something, you know, and you can toss those out, but you still have a good core of good sightings.
The whole idea of talking to these people, and I imagine once one person kind of opened up in small communities like that, everybody kind of would follow thereafter. I assume you camped out or stayed at places, as you said earlier, where people had numerous sightings. What was your thoughts then? I mean, when you first get there, you think, well, maybe this is a possibility, maybe it's not. But once you've been there for a while, talk to the people. And I know exactly what you're saying, because I've had the same thing happen to me. You realize that there is a great possibility. So your thoughts when you're camping out and spending a lot of time in that swamp changes dramatically, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. And I think that kind of translates to the people, the naysayers that just kind of off the cuff, like, well, that can't be possible. It's just some bunch of made up, or it's a big hoax. It's like, usually the people that say that stuff don't have any perspective on it. They've never been to Falk, Arkansas, or wherever, you know, wherever it is that they're dismissing. They haven't been to the specific Northwest and hiked up into the, you know, the remote mountains. And so, you know, that's the thing. Yeah, your perspective changes, and that's why my books, why I've gotten a good response, I think, is because I go to the places. You know, I can describe the place. I'm there. I'm not just simply relating everyone's story. I'm actually interjecting my own thoughts and my own observations as I, you know, put the boots on the ground or the canoe in the swamp and, you know, kind of evaluate the case as a whole. So yeah, my whole perspective, I felt like something had gone on, but certainly once I was there and I'm talking to the people, it was like, wow, yeah, there's something weird going on here.
Has the area changed at all since the first time you went down there to now?
Somewhat. I mean, and actually lately they're in some kind of a project to drain Mercer Bayou and clean out the channel and let it fill back up. I know it's a weird thing because I'd been up there last year and suddenly these swamps which were like literally teeming with alligators are now just a trench with overgrown vegetation. It was bizarre. And even low-lying areas that kind of were basically like a lake. I mean, it was just really bottoms, but it looked like a lake through the cypress. I mean, it was like a muddy, it looked like another planet. I mean, I was like, wow, this is so weird. And I thought, it looked like you could just walk right across it. But as soon as I put my foot down there, my boot sank about 3 feet. And I'm like, whoa, this is like super mud. But, you know, otherwise, though, really, I mean, not there hasn't been any major developments or they don't. You know, a lot of that stuff is just, it's either sanctioned off as wildlife conservation area, as the wildlife management, or is simply undeveloped. You know, you can't develop. It's just too swampy. You'd have to really put in some, you know, you have to do some major renovation to develop it. So a lot of it just remains as it is. And much of that, you can still go to places. I know places where it was shown in the movie in 1970, filmed in 1971, it looks exactly the same. I go to the site and I'm like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah. Since they've done these projects down there, as the sightings, are they not as often now, or did that change whatsoever?
You know, I kind of thought that it might, disrupt things and there'd be more sightings, or, you know, we've also had a lot of flooding lately, like, at least once or twice a year, we've had these serious flooding situations where you know, it tends to run things out of the bottoms, and I'll see, you know, I'll see snakes like slithering across the old highway, you know, and weird stuff like that. But I didn't find that it really increased the sightings. I mean, I still get the reports about the same frequency as I always do, which is really only get, I don't know, maybe it could be anywhere from 5 or 7 current new reports a year, and then, you know, other stories that may be older, but it's remained about the same, I think.
I know that when we had Bob Jackson on, the Yellowstone Park Ranger, who sighted the big Yellowstone, but he said after they had the big fires in Yellowstone for about 6 years, there were no sightings. It's like they moved completely out of the area. So I didn't know if there was anything like that at Bogey Creek and Falk, Arkansas. So we're talking with Lyle Blackburn, musician, and gosh, these wonderful books we're going to talk. And I, you know, Lyle, I really messed up because when I was there at Hocking Hills, I wanted to pop over there and get one of your books. And next thing I know, it was over and I was going home. I said, man, how stupid can one be? So I'm going to have to get with you and pick one up and add to my collection here on the Animal Compound, my Bigfoot stuff. So it's going to have to do that.
Absolutely. I know how that is. I go to those conferences and I want to bring home, you know, I've got things I need to bring home, and then I've also got, you know, everything I've brought or the rest of what I need to bring home. It often turns into hard to shop in those situations. But we'll hook you up here. We'll fix you up.
Oh, okay. This is Wild World. We're talking to Lyle Blackburn. What a fantastic show. We're going to talk more on cryptozoology, more music. Of course, we're brought to you by SRI Records, SRI Label Group, and Shelly Leibowitz here on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
SRI Jazz is proud to present their newest release, This is Ray Brown Jr. That's right, Ella Fitzgerald's son continues to entertain audiences with his warm and charming vocals, making this one of the best vocal jazz albums of the year. Here are some sample tracks from the album. Visit our website to hear all of them in their entirety. Just go to srirecords.com or click on the banner in your media player now.
It's wonderful, marvelous, you should care for me. Awful nights, paradise, what I love to see. My baby, when she walks by, all the fellas go, I know why. Simply 'cause that girl's so fine. If she'd ever leave me, I'd lose my mind. She's got the kind of loving, kissing and a hugging. Sure, he's mellow. Glad that I'm a fella, and I know, 'cause she knocked me off my feet. Have mercy on me. I know for certain, one I love. I'm through with flirting. It's you that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving. Say, take the A train to go to Sugar Hill, way up in all.
You've been listening to a few sample tracks from the new album, This is Ray Brown Jr. You can hear all the songs in their entirety at srirecords.com. Support jazz music today at srirecords.com. Consideration provided by SRI Jazz.
Hi everyone, this is Shelly Leibowitz. You're listening to my friend Larry Batson's Wild, Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
pretty hot.
Did we lose
Thank
Lyle?
You very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I thought we...
Time delay.
You guys have toured around the world?
Yeah, we've toured quite a bit. We haven't done, like, Japan or anything, but a lot of... we've done Europe and Canada and played, of course, North America quite a bit. So made the rounds.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're getting back to the Boggy Creek. What was your greatest find out here? Did you hear something or see something that really brought it all together?
I've never had a sighting myself, unfortunately. You know, I've many times felt it was imminent, but, I think those things are not something you simply conjure up. You know, you can put yourself in the right place, but some amount of luck, I'm sure. But, there has been occasions where things have happened that, you know, defied our own explanation and we felt could be the creatures, and one of those was specifically hearing a vocalization that occurred while a friend of mine and myself were up in the swamp one night and heard this kind of a strange howling. Howling is about the best I can describe it, but not, you know, not your typical suspects like, coyotes and wolves or foxes or something like that. It was something we couldn't identify, and it occurred at regular intervals for a while, and whatever this thing was eventually or apparently followed us down the bayou channel until we got out of our canoe and got up on this hill where we were camped, and whatever this thing was then suddenly made this vocalization right across that water, right down from where we were. Which, of course, you know, was really spooky and startling. And then we were scrambling around to record that and to then get the lights and try to see if we could spot whatever it was, because it was really close. And unfortunately, we couldn't, you know, we never could get the light beam on it. It just took off into the woods and then howled from a distance. But it's those little incidents, and, we were in another pretty remote and spooky place one night, and I'm not normally spooked by anything. I can walk around in the dark out in the swamp and no problem, but even then, sometimes, you know, we came across what looked like a fairly fresh large footprint that had come across this little two rut, looked like an ATV track, and that makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck, and it all kind of comes together when you're like, wow, you know, it's one thing to read about this or talk to somebody who's seen it, but to be out here and to kind of think that, wow, it could be out there, like, you know, 20 yards away, just sitting in the dark watching us, it gives you a whole different perspective. So those incidents have kind of kept my, you know, the carrot dangling there that possibly I could have a sighting myself.
Well, I undoubtedly it was. I've tried to tell these researchers, per se, that once from dusk till dawn, they are invisible. I mean, they are almost impossible to spot in any habitat because of their coloring. I mean, and as you know, one can be within 10 foot of you, and you would have no idea unless you were downwind from it. And they're that elusive. And it's, what do you tell people when they say they think they come off spaceships?
I try to just nod and listen to their perspective. But yeah, I just. I'm like, okay, let's just not add more puzzle pieces to the puzzle. Let's just keep this a little simpler. I don't know. I mean, I don't know any. I can't be definitive in my hypothesis, but I don't. Yeah, that just gets way out there. And I've never had anybody tell me, oh, I saw a spaceship land and they got off it. It's always like, there was a weird light, and then suddenly we saw something in the woods. Well, you know, how are these connected? leaps
Well, I have to tell you, the first time I was invited to go to Newcomers Town, the old Bigfoot conference they used to have at a school, and I went over there to speak. This has been, gosh, well, I'll tell you, Smokey Crabtree was there. So that was, my gosh, 25 years, maybe. Not sure.
Yeah.
And I had I'm walking up there to the building to speak, and this guy comes up to me. He says, "How you doing? Are you our speaker?" I said, "Well, yes, I am." He says, "I don't know nothing about Bigfoot, but I'll tell you, I've been abducted by aliens, and they tried to stick needles in my penis." And I thought, 7 hours drive back home. Do I want to just climb back in that car and go back home after that, or find out this entire group that I'm about to speak to is that whack? It was like, my gosh. I have to tell go ahead.
I was gonna say, yeah, that seems like something to bring up on the second date, not right when you meet up.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, when I went over to Shepherdstown, West Virginia, to speak to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on Bigfoot, this was in, 2001 or two, I think. Or maybe it was nine. That's not for it. But anyway, there was a couple guys from South Carolina that had come up there, and that's quite a drive. I think it's like 400 or 500 miles from South Carolina where they were at, to just outside of Washington, D.C., and they'd messed up on the dates. In fact, they'd come a week earlier, and they found out that the conference wasn't until the next, or that my talk wasn't until the next weekend. So they come back, and they walked up to me, and they said, "I got something I want to show you out in our car." I said, "Okay." So I walked out there, and they had this casting. And I know you've done work with this, but Lyle, it was a beautiful, beautiful casting, which basically looked like a giant lizard foot. And what they explained to me was they heard something screaming in the swamp, tearing off a bark off the cypress trees, and as soon as they got close to it, it took off through the swamp. They didn't really see it, but they heard it, and then it left these footprints that they made these castings. And it was quite impressive. So here's what I did, is I went and got a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service person. I said, "Come here. I want you to look at this. I want your impression." This was a wildlife biologist. And I said, "What is that?" And he looks at this casting. And he kind of looks at me. Then he looks at those guys. He goes, "This is screwed up. This is screwed up. I don't know what the heck this is supposed to be, but this is screwed up." And he just walked away. I mean, it was like unbelievable.
Were they three-toed tracks by any chance?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure. With a claw.
Yeah. Right. I get a few of those since I wrote the book on that lizard man case from South Carolina. You know, oftentimes people send me, you know, I love the swamp environments, obviously, so I get a lot of those weird kind of footprints, you know, that they're way more rare than, say, a Bigfoot track, but yeah, they're always kind of a three-toed, clawed looking thing, and occasionally I can have a possible explanation, but some of them are just plain unexplainable. I don't know.
Well, I will tell you, I cleaned up what the wildlife man said. He didn't say it was screwed up. He used another word. And he was absolutely flabbergasted. And I just laughed. I said, "Well, there you go. You know, it's a weird world." We're talking to Lyle Blackburn. He's also the front man for Ghoultown. And we love the music, so we're going to have some more here on Blog Talk. Mine tonight. What a great song. Wow, man, you guys, I'm telling you. How would you say they're a hot Dr. Day?
That's right.
So now that you've done this for all these years, Lyle, of course, I know everybody at one will ask you about what your impressions of the Patterson film. And by the way, Dr. Day, I forgot to mention this. We had a chance to actually have an impromptu concert from Lyle, an acoustic concert, at the hall we were staying at Hocking Hills for the Bigfoot Conference, which is pretty darn impressive.
That's right. Yeah, I borrowed the guitar there and played a. I'm not as much of a, an acoustic performer, but we do have some songs that lend itself to that. And in fact, that was the first time Dr. Meldrum had ever heard me actually sing or play. I mean, I've known him for years and years. So I think he was like, "Wow, I guess he hasn't been exposed to the music side." So I think. That was a cool thing. But, yeah, it was that was a fun conference. And people always ask me, how come you didn't bring your guitar? It's like, well, I got all this other stuff. It's hard to bring that, too. But occasionally I will whip out one and play a tune. Or I even the Texas conference once I played the song, the Travis Crabtree song from the old Legend of Boggy Creek movie. So that was kind of cool.
That is cool.
Yeah, and Dr. Meldrum, he's probably the number one person now in the Bigfoot field, I would have to say. He's a pretty nice guy, even though I did harass him periodically throughout the conference. But he seemed to have a pretty good sense of humor about it.
Yeah, and it's funny about Meldrum because I can remember being on tour, and I remember when his Legend Meet Science book came out, and I'd read all those kind of books, and I'd be sitting over there in the van or whatever while we were touring. I remember reading that book, thinking, "Wow, this guy's he's definitely the ultimate, scientist that's looking into Bigfoot or what have you." And then it's really surreal to later be sharing the stage with him as a speaker and all that, or now we're buddies, but I just think back to driving around the tour bus and all the guys were always like, "Can we keep reading all these, these Bigfoot books and stuff?" I was like, "Bigfoot, man, this is cool stuff." And, that's kind of what led to me wanting to write a book. I mean, I'd had writing jobs all along, like in a professional way, like I'd written for music magazines and other things. So I always, was good at writing, and it was a way to supplement music when I wasn't, traveling or playing shows or what have you. But, and that's the difference. I come at it as a writer. A lot of people are Bigfoot researchers and then feel they need to write a book for whatever reason. And then mine was more like, I'm a writer who is interested in this subject. So I thought, if I'm going to write a book, this is kind of my favorite stuff, especially the Boggy Creek case, which is kind of a local, something close to me. So that's kind of what ended up inspiring me to write the book, which then springboarded into me speaking at conferences, which now I'm hanging out with you and Meldrum. And so all that's always kind of trips me out. It's fun stuff.
It is fun stuff. In fact, when I first started getting interested in it, well, I've been involved with it for, close to 50
years.
I knew, even before all these television shows, that there was something to this. And my main thing was, what a great teaching tool this Bigfoot thing can be, especially for the young people. And I've encouraged every young person I've seen that's interested in Bigfoot. I said, "Hey, start your own research group. Go out in the woods, discover the woods and look for Bigfoot, but also discover the other animals that live in the woods and learn about them as well." And, so I thought way back then when it started coming out with the all these shows, which some of them are pretty darn close to ridiculous. Of course, my big favorite is Not Finding Bigfoot, and that their methods and so forth. But, it was the number one show on Animal Planet for a long, long time, so what can I say about it? And that's got people interested in the subject. So, in fact, I was kind of mad at myself for years forever bringing up the area of Morgan Monroe State Forest, because now every weekend there's at least two or three research groups in that area looking for Bigfoot. And as my wife said, if you're looking for it, you're not going to find it.
Right. That's what I always say. It's like, you know, you're out there and researching, yet I just interviewed, you know, a string of people, which included, you know, some woman who could care less about Bigfoot, who was driving on some county road and suddenly sighted something. Even a, you know, there was even a newspaper carrier up in near in Texarkana, which is close to Falk, Arkansas, and she saw something early morning. I'm like, you know, I could be out, I could either go be risking life and limb in the swamp trying to see something, or I could just go get a paper route and just as much probability of a sighting. So yeah, it's, I always feel like looking or finding or those kind of things are representative of they're good and they get people out, but it's not the way animals and wildlife work. You got to have a lot of patience and sometimes just be in the right place at the right time, of course, to, you know, yeah, see, you know, if you're looking for a wolverine or something. I mean, it's not like, well, we're wolverine hunters, we're going to go see one every weekend. No, it doesn't work that way. It's like you have to put some time in.
Yeah, well, years ago, I was invited by a scientist to go do a wolverine count in Glacier National Park, and I thought, and of course, they go in January and February, so that didn't sound too appealing to me. And of course, you're looking for a needle in a haystack. And the fellow that was the expert on wolverines flat told me, he said, wolverines will go places even mountain goats won't go. I said, really? He says, absolutely. In fact, they found they had a, just to show you how their movements are, Lyle, they had one tagged in the Tetons, and they could, it was a radio collar, and that wolverine traveled to the Teton and ended up in Rocky Mountain National Park in Estes Park, Colorado, which is, excuse me, I think about 400 miles away between the two. So
that's amazing. And I think that's one thing that people do a disservice to animals right off the bat, especially with this, like the questions about the UFOs and from space. I'm like, look, folks, animals do very amazing and unexpected things. They are suitable, you know, well suited for whatever environment they live in. Their coloration, their hair makes camouflage that people just, you know, oh, well, it seemed to vanish. Yeah, because that's what animals do. They can blend in with the woods. They don't need superpowers. They you know, people just totally underestimate the abilities of animals. And if we were to, you know, say that, you know, if we go under the assumption that there is a Bigfoot creature out there, and it is presumably more intelligent than your average animal, then that, you know, that's a whole nother set of possibilities that these things could remain elusive. While it seems maybe improbable, it's not impossible that they could be living out there, and people just don't quite recognize that that's possible, I think, by underestimating what animals can do.
Well, and dude, it kind of bothers me when someone, you know, comes up and says, yeah, no, if these things existed, we'd have killed one by now, or the government would have one by now, blah, 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 there is no way, no way. And I'll ask myself, well, how many books have you actually read on the subject? How much have you looked into it? Oh, not really that much. I said, well, then how can you express an opinion like that? I mean, that makes no sense.
Yeah, most opinions are just kind of this weird gut reaction. And I think sometimes with these subjects, it's almost like they have that extreme opinion or this absolute, like it can't exist, because they're afraid if they admit that there's a possibility, then their peers will go, oh, you believe in Bigfoot. Like, you know, it's almost like this kind of overcompensation for making sure that nobody thinks they're crazy. You know, and it's just this sort of a gut feeling they have based on zero research. They've never read a book. You're like, well, there's no evidence. I'm like, I've seen numerous footprint casts that cannot be explained. Do you know these, you know, do you know the Elkins Creek cast? Do you know the Freeman cast? You know, they don't know any of these, you know, presumed pieces of evidence. So it's kind of frustrating that people look at it that way, but
When John Green was alive, and this was about 7 or 8 years ago, he approached me about coming to Harrison Hot Springs, and they had made a cast or a copy of the cast of the Skookum cast. And he asked me, well, how much would it cost for me to pay you to take it all across the country and share it with different scientists, like George Schaller in Chicago and other scientists around the country. And I said, John, it would be, you know, I don't know what kind of finances you have, but it would be rather expensive to pay me fuel and motels and so forth to do this, plus leave my responsibilities here at home of all these wild animals. And, you know, in some ways, Lyle, I kind of regret I didn't do that, because I think it would have been a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, wow, what an opportunity. Yeah, that, yeah, you know, I'm of course, you know, respect John Green, and he's one big influence on the way I write my books. But, yeah, and that's always a problem, though. It's like the expenses and the things that would incur to be able to share that are often prohibitive of doing it. So, you know, you're right there with a lot of us.
Yeah. Well, just to show you, when we set up our first exhibit, I actually constructed an 8-foot replica. I was, after I was really into it, in fact, my wife said I was basically ate up with it for about 5 years. I was doing so much stuff, research, and talking to so many people, that I thought, with all this evidence there is out there, that someone's going to find one, and they're going to say my statue doesn't look anything like them. I was actually worried about that. So, you know, it was like, oh, my God. But it was, that's, you know, still. And I can still remember the little old lady that came up to me when I was doing a lecture at a library on the subject, and she came up to me, and she touched my hand. She says, you know, I've seen them many times. They said they live around me. She says, people should just leave them alone. And she turned around and walked away. And, you know, I couldn't agree with her more.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of this amounts to that. It just people just would prefer they left alone. And I think I'm sure the creatures themselves would probably go for that as well. But, you know, I don't know that you've got these guys who definitely want to prove it, and obviously to prove it, you're going to need a specimen. Nothing else is going to be suitable at this point. There's too much CGI and fakery, and, you know, and it's like, I don't know if they, you know, I've never been one to, let's take up arms and go try to shoot one. That's not my purpose in life, but I don't know if they got one, would it help to preserve their environment or not? I mean, I don't think even endangered species are not doing well themselves, and even the proven ones aren't able to, convince companies not to develop land and keep messing up rainforests. And so I don't know. I'm never quite sure whether it would help if we had a specimen or whether just leave them alone and be done. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll leave that thought out there. Dr. Day, what an amazing show today.
Yes, we knew it was going to be. Unfortunately, we just don't have enough time, do we?
There is never enough time. My God. Oh, you didn't tell Lyle what he won when he beat me in Who Got Nowhere.
Oh, well, yes, Lyle, if you're going to love this, you get to be on the show again.
Hey, that's a good prize. I'll accept that.
Lyle Blackburn, man, you've got a great spirit. Very nice fella. You know, I see your pictures of Bigfoot researchers, and I have to explain, when I was first involved with John Green, something came along with John Green that harassed me and kind of put a sour taste in my mouth toward the other Bigfoot researchers. And that particular person was a guy called Rene DeHinden. And so whenever I go to these conferences and I see speakers, I think, oh, I wonder if he's a nice guy, you know. And when I met Lyle Blackburn, he's just great. He's fantastic. I mean, this is what this research, this community needs. And you're an outstanding spokesman for it. And I didn't get a chance to tell you, but I was quite impressed with your speech at Hocking Hill. I thought it was just great. Just great.
Well, thank you very much. I'm definitely one of those, the opposite of DeHinden. I'm more of a let's let's keep Bigfoot fun. Let's keep cryptids exciting. And it's a, you know, it's a good, crazy world out there. And who knows what could lurk in the fringes of our forests. So I just have a good time with it. I love the outdoors. I love, you know, spooky stories, just everything about it. And so I always, my intention is to, you know, have a good time with it.
That's right. That's what it's all about.
Amen.
Well, Lyle, thanks for being on the show. We're going to finish up. All I want to remind everyone, of course, we're underwritten by SRI Records. Go to their website, srirecords.com. Incredible collection of country, jazz, blues, and rock. And you don't get just samples of the songs. You can have a chance to actually listen to the entire cut for free. And if you want to download it, that's available as well at a very reasonable price. So it's SRI Records, and they make it possible for us to be on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to finish up with Ghoultown, Southern Sun, here on Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good afternoon, everybody.
Thanks, Lyle. Thanks, Lyle.
Take
Happy
care.
Veterans Day to all our veterans.
Yes, you betcha. God bless them.
Wild, Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.